The entire Pentagon runs off of Excel and PowerPoint, and especially for some of Naval Aviation's, you know, mission planning and readiness systems, we're being asked to manage these things that are unmanageable. Like, literally, there's just no tech that actually is there to help you do it. So, and it doesn't matter how well capitalized a company is, they're going to be standing in the same line as everybody else. In order to get the classified contract, you need a SCIF, but you are not allowed to build a SCIF until you have a classified contract. This problem is a really bad reason to lose to China, really bad reason to lose the great power competition, all because we can't engage the best parts of the U.S. economy in this world. Just learn faster, fail faster. Just because it's not sexy does not mean it is not a fantastic opportunity and a real, real problem to solve.
Welcome to Secure Access with John Dillard, your front door to the future of compliance, security, and tech. Powered by Sign-In Solutions, we bring you bold conversations with industry leaders who are shaping how organizations protect people, data, and spaces. If you're serious about smarter, safer access, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
Sean, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining me. It's great to see you again. I think you and I, and maybe Hunter, were in contact, your co-founder, Hunter. We're in touch. Oh my gosh. It must be 6 years ago.
Yeah. At least 2021, I think is put together pretty quickly after Nix was founded. So it must have been around that time.
Yeah. Because ThreatSwitch, my company, this is before it was acquired by Sign-In. You know, we're selling in the defense industrial base. We're both selling in, and we crossed paths in that process. Always thought that Nix, your company, which we'll learn all about today, was a very cool idea. So I'm very excited to hear the story and get a little bit more info from you. But your background, it's great when you do these podcasts because you get to find out all kinds of things about folks you've met before that you didn't know. So Naval Academy grad, fighter pilot, F-18s, correct? Had a bunch of data analysis and ML machine learning roles for the Navy, founded an organization that applied some of that back into the defense industrial base, which was Force Readiness Analytics Group, if we've got the name right. You were at Facebook at a very interesting time. We had Tim Wenzel on the podcast a couple months ago who may have overlapped with you. Yeah. So I've heard some of those stories and it sounds utterly terrifying.
Really terrifying, but
as a security person trying to not get people in trouble, that had to have been something. But my goodness, I mean, it's quite the story. It makes me want to know, how did you get from fighter pilot to this? How did you get pulled into this before you founded Nix?
John, I don't know. No, it's I tell you, it only makes sense when looking backwards, right? But the story is an interesting one. So really, you know, all the way back, I had a more technical background all the way from my undergrad and master's education. And so when I was flying, loved flying, but I was doing a lot of things that pilots are never supposed to do, which is code. So in my spare time, you know, we had these high-tech jets and the lowest tech everything else, right? The entire Pentagon runs off of Excel and PowerPoint. And especially for some of Naval Aviation's, you know, mission planning and readiness systems, you know, we're being asked to manage these things that are unmanageable. Like literally, there's just no tech that actually is there to help you do it. So I ended up doing just some software development for the Navy, for the squadrons. A couple of those software solutions took hold. So my last job in the Navy was actually standing up that Force Analytics, Readiness Analytics Group, FRAG, as you said, with really the mandate of, hey, how is Naval Aviation using AI, ML to help solve Naval Aviation readiness problems? To the surprise of nobody, we weren't using it, and we really couldn't at the time. We simply did not have the data infrastructure and availability to be able to take full advantage of the technologies. But we did some great things at FRAG to really get that off the ground. That was under Admiral Bullitt Miller, Cesar Cherico, innovative leaders that supported that work. But what it really did was got me in broader contact with the rest of the defense innovation ecosystem. And it's where I met my two other co-founders. So David Willard, call sign MUD, Air Force F-15 background, Pentagon, and then was early days over at DIUX at the time under Mike Brown and Raj Shah. Hunter Price helped stand up Defense Digital Services. He owned the Air Force portfolio over there as another Force of the Future initiative under Ash Carter. Eventually was Kessel Run's first CTO, an Air Force software factory out of Boston. And so very basically, you know, we got into this because our jobs by the end of our military and government careers were to get what we call non-traditional defense contractors onto contract with the Department of Defense. And, you know, this is everybody else, right? Your software startups, your Silicon Valley crowds. And really what we found in those roles was that as long as the contract was unclassified, we could move pretty quickly. The second it went classified, unless that company had an existing security clearance and access to an existing secure facility called a SCIF, a Sensitive Compartmentalized Information Facility, unless they had those things ready, we as the government could not give them the work. And it's very much a chicken and the egg problem. SCIFs are millions of dollars to build and maintain, but more importantly, years of time. And it doesn't matter how well capitalized a company is, they're going to be standing in the same line as everybody else. In order to get the classified contract, you need a SCIF, but you are not allowed to build a SCIF until you have a classified contract. The government will not allow you to build that risk because they don't know who is involved, how it's built. They will not do it. They will not accredit it. And so really, you know, the basic thesis behind Nooks is that we as a nation aren't getting access to our country's best tech and talent into our most sensitive programs. We're getting whatever's available from the category of companies that have SCIFs. And, you know, Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon, they are fantastic firms. They make great planes, tanks, and missiles. But that is a very different technology stack than what is happening in Silicon Valley these days. Right? So when we look at this, we say, hey, look, we're not able to get best tech and talent into our most sensitive programs, all because of this access to infrastructure, to SCIF issue, right? There's a lot of reasons why it's hard to contract and work with the government. This problem is a really bad reason to lose to China, really bad reason to lose the great power competition, all because we can't engage the best parts of the U.S. economy in this work. So we saw the problem through a particular lens. We knew that back in the mid-teens when Forstman and Nash Carter was around. We weren't the first folks to identify this as an issue. Nooks was born in 2021, really out of COVID. I'll get more into that in a little bit on why the timing is so important with this. For my background, I left active duty in 2019. I did go to Facebook, Meta for a few years, do it in anti-misinformation operations during the 2020 election and COVID, which was weird time to be there for sure. But I tell you, the difference in technology that you could deploy at a place like Meta versus a three-star staff inside of DoD is stark. We were able to do things at Meta that would have taken years if it would ever happen inside of the DoD. So it's a great opportunity to see how do these firms do it? How do the giants really make this happen? How is the sausage really made? And you know, a lot of people give Meta a hard time for a variety of reasons. But what I found within their trust and safety department was a lot of people that were very mission-driven, trying to solve an impossible problem. Misinformation is a huge issue. And regardless of where you fall on the political spectrum, there's no good answer to it, right? Left, right. We let Pandora out of the box when it comes to social media. And there's just simply no good way to put that back in the box. So the world and society is still struggling with those things. But it's definitely colored my view as we started Nooks of like, okay, how do these large, you know, engineering firms do this? And how can we take some of those lessons and apply it to the security industry, which is a non-traditional route? So
But you picked a tough one to start. I mean, starting Nooks, I mean, you've explained a little bit about what SCIFs are and maybe a little bit more on exactly what's involved in that will be helpful for everybody here. But, you know, it's a pretty capital intensive thing. So software startups are hard enough, right? You are in a weird category. In a very capital intensive problem that is, I think I've heard you talk about, that's an overlap between prop tech and security and cyber and about seven other disciplines. Founders joke about this all the time. We will say, hey, it took an act of Congress. And you joked with me that it actually took an act of Congress to kind of get the situation to a place where you could do this. Tell us a little bit about the founding process. Figured out this is a problem. You know, it's tough. It's a real thing that everybody knows needs to be done. But it's going to be hard. Surely you must have known this. How did you get over that hump? What was the impetus and how did you make it happen?
I got to say, I think every founder will agree with this statement. Ignorance is bliss. You need to be Roadrunner instead of Wile E. Coyote. You need to run off the cliff without knowing that what you're doing is probably impossible. And we knew it was going to be hard. But me, Mud Hunter, what you did not hear in our backgrounds was a whole bunch of SCIF building and operation, right? We came at this from the defense innovation perspective, which meant we had been users of SCIFs. We had used them, but we hadn't built them and we certainly hadn't gotten them accredited before. So it was a huge learning curve. And really, John, I'm sure you did the same thing at ThreatSwitch. We spent the first 6-8 months just talking to people, right? Hearing what the pain points were, understanding what users of various types really needed in order to make this work, and even just to justify to ourselves that we weren't drinking our own Kool-Aid, right? That there was a real problem to be had here and a business model that could scale. So we interviewed government, we interviewed large, medium, small companies, universities. We talked with everybody we possibly could. And what we consistently found was that it didn't matter who you were. This sucked, right? Nobody was satisfied with where the country had landed in terms of getting access to this infrastructure. And it's more than just, you know, the chicken and the egg thing is certainly, you know, a part of this, but even companies that have SCIFs and are well capitalized and have them all over the place, what we realized very quickly was that this is a giant pain in the ass for everybody based off the way that we've set this policy. And just to kind of frame the problem, when the rules for classified facilities were established by the government, there were a couple hundred thousand people with clearances. The model they pursued at the time was one of specialized infrastructure as a result. That made sense. And the model was one company, one contract, one SCIF, very specific. That made a ton of sense to protect information from each other. Just because you and I have a top secret clearance does not mean that we could start talking about what we know. It's very compartmentalized. So that model made complete sense when there was a couple hundred thousand people with clearances. There was approaching near 5 million Americans with security clearances. And the system that we set up did not scale, right? The system of bespoke infrastructure simply did not serve that magnitude of user base. So when we spoke with everybody, we're like, okay, we see that we understand what the problem is intimately. We've lived it. We've seen it up close. Now we understand why it exists the way it does. What can be done about it? So we came up with this, you know, we had a pretty good idea that a shared infrastructure model would probably make more sense with this. And that wasn't unique. This isn't unique to defense, right? Actually, a great example in the past to point to is that fractional biotech labs. You know, it used to be 20 years ago that every company would build its own lab and run its own experiments. And that was fine. That works. But when you're trying to move fast and you're trying to run more patents, more experiments, learn faster, fail faster, what they found was that doing a shared fractional lab model was way more efficient for everybody. You could run those experiments at a fraction of the cost, a fraction of the time through ready-made infrastructure. And we saw that the same thing could happen with SCIFs. That's essentially the same thing. You have this high upfront cost, hardened infrastructure in a physical space and a specialized workforce, in this case, people with clearances as opposed to scientists. So there's some corollaries in other industries. And we said, okay, cool. How can we apply that same model to SCIFs? Now, the challenge with getting started, John, as you pointed to, it's not demand problem. We actually weren't even the first people to identify the problem set and how painful it was. I do think we're the first company to really put all of the pieces and parts together on how you're going to do this at scale and how the scale that it needs to be done. So it really took us thinking creatively, but also just terribly logically about what is the problem and what is the solution that would make the most sense. What I think we didn't fully appreciate, I'll tell you, we've been extremely advantaged. There's a lot of people that are really pissed off by this problem. And we've hit the timing very, very well. And we've been able to attract just fantastic talent to this company in a way that you wouldn't think a SCIF company could attract this type of talent. But we have a bunch of people who have dedicated their lives to solving this and nothing but this, because we want, you know, this is a great opportunity to solve a national security problem at scale in a way that nobody else has.
It's really interesting you mentioned that, because very much my experience at ThreatSwitch too. I mean, you know, compliance is a pretty boring problem. I mean, SCIFs are a compliance-driven requirement is what it is. But once you get folks who kind of put two and two together on, oh, if we solve this, we're actually making a material difference in the ability for warfighters to do what they need to do, for R&D to happen the way it needs to happen, for government policy to be effective. I mean, it improves countless numbers of lives and jobs in a way that's pretty important. And once they figure that out, it sounds like you guys figured that out early. I was shocked by the kind of talent we were able to attract. So,
well, it's funny. We had when we were speaking with investors, that one of the reactions we got, you know, love the VC community. They're great in a lot of ways. But one of the things that, you know, they know that they do to themselves, like they chase the shining object a lot, right? Whatever the hot new thing is. And we were told, oh man, love what you guys are doing, but it's just not sexy, right? It's not sexy. And
sometimes people will pay for it and they're not very sexy.
Well, here's why, you know, what I do miss about my active duty time, military mindset. Like, yeah, it might not be sexy, but it's not about that. It's about effectiveness, right? It's about what is the solution to the problem that everybody has that needs to happen now. And our counterpoint to that was like, hey, running servers, you know, running a server farm isn't terribly sexy either, but what you can do with cloud is fascinating. And once you have that infrastructure in place, all of those use cases and all of the different things you could do with it becomes very interesting for a variety of reasons. So just because it's not sexy does not mean it is not a fantastic opportunity and a real problem to solve. So
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about that problem a little bit more. I'd love to unpack, because there are many dimensions to this, right? And you and I have talked about it, that it's not just special real estate. It's more, way more than that. And we can start with the tech components of it, or the national security components, or the compliance components of it, the great power competition components of it. You know, take your pick, but I guess what are the most important parts of this problem that absolutely must get solved? And let's talk a little bit about what those are, so people understand the gravity of why it's so important to solve it.
Yeah. So I'm actually going to, just for the benefit of some of your listeners who probably have no idea what a SCIF is, it's actually been in the public's awareness a lot recently with some pretty high profile cases. And this is by no means political at all. This is just, you know, stories as they've developed. You know, we have high level politicians from both sides of the aisle that have struggled to keep classified information in places where it's meant to be, as SCIFs, right? We have Signal being used to securely communicate. And there was a great article that came out about that situation, and it pointed to the fact, like, yes, Signal, the real problem is that people can't have easy access to the facilities where you can't.
It's too hard.
We've made it
too much work.
Too much work. We've made it so stinking hard to do work within the defense and intelligence community. Like, software actually has a great concept around this. They always talk like frictionless transactions, right? Making it very easy to do with things the right way, because it's the easiest path, the path of least resistance. And only building in friction intentionally, where you want people to slow down for a very specific reason, that still can be a smooth process as long as it's intentional. What we've done is, you know, as a nation, is essentially made it, you know, the pendulum swings between like security and effectiveness. Like, the most secure box is one that I can never get into, but it's not terribly effective, right? And we let that pendulum go a little bit too far to one way based off a compliance-only mindset. And it's a natural thing. It happens in all sorts of industries. It happens in cyber. It happens in regulatory environments all the time. But there's a recognition, I think, now, and really what drove it is actually COVID. The government had, you know, sent its workforce to the four winds, right? Everybody went home. And for the first time, the government didn't have access to its own SCIFs and didn't have distributed access to secure infrastructure the way that they thought they did. And so we use that as a moment of time. Okay, now's the moment. If there's ever a time to do this, the government wants to bring in these non-traditional vendors for technology development, software development, in a way that it hasn't done in decades. There's this great power competition happening. COVID has driven the government to a place where they're willing to accept it. And commercial real estate is struggling immensely due to people going work from home. Well, you know what you can't do from home? Classified work, right? So it was a great confluence of events that led to this being the right time to solve something like this. And there was actually existing legislative tailwinds that said, hey, you know, this should be the way that things are done. So the model of like shared access to this infrastructure had been out there in the ether already. And we were able to say, all right, cool, let's do it. Let's actually do it. Let's don't make it a secondary offering. Don't bolt it onto the side of something else or some other program. Let's make it a primary offering. So, you know, why is this so hard was your original question. And it's hard for a variety of reasons. The first and foremost is the regulatory environment. Cannot do this without being explicitly told from the government, yes, you can proceed. So it starts and ends with the government contract. And it is a well-established fact that working with the government is not necessarily the easiest thing in the world, especially when you're trying to do something new. So we spent the first several years of the company ensuring that we had the right contract, the right permissions, the right support from the important places to be able to start to execute on something like this, which was no trivial task. It really took the entire company using our collective backgrounds in the defense and nation space and whole careers in national security to do something like that. The next reason why this is hard is SCIFs are actually pretty, like, it's no easy task to build them. Like, you essentially have to turn it into a Faraday cage where no electromagnetic signals can come in or out. Well, that's a pretty big space. I mean, our sites are, you know, 50, 60,000 square feet. It is no joke on how to turn something of that size into a Faraday cage, along with, you know, all of the other rules that go along with it. So the physical construction and the cost of it is certainly a huge factor. The third one, John, which I'm sure will resonate with you, is the IT environment is exceptionally challenging on the government side, specifically the secure communications networks. There are over 1,000 different classified networks that the government uses. It is incredibly complex, and it's not for any particularly logical reason other than it's very hard for the government to work together. So it's easier to do your own thing, which is how you wind up with that.
All these agencies are driving their own standards and sub networks, and sometimes they talk and sometimes they don't.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, people always joke that like DoD is the 800-pound gorilla in the room because they're a huge budget, and they're not. They're 801-pound gorillas.
Sounds horrible.
Yeah, right. When they all go in the same direction.
Definitely worse than one gorilla.
Yeah, like very deadly when they all go in the same direction. But like there are 800. It's just Lord of the Flies out there, right? So things happen, and you know, every time they try to work together, it becomes too hard, so they disintegrate back in their own things. So you wind up in this incredibly difficult IT environment to navigate. So when we look at this, you know, really all the shared SCIF piece of this is just the beginning. It really is. How do you have a common set of capabilities at all these sites? You don't want to play the game of which nook has which network. You want to consistently deploy the capability at all the sites that services, you know, 80, 90% of the workforce out there. You're never going to solve all of the use cases, but what's the majority chunk that the people really need to be able to move quickly? And that's really what this is about how quickly can we get the best tech and the best talent working these programs as quickly as possible so that we can be terribly, terribly effective as a nation.
Yeah. And on the tech stack, in addition to the government networks that you've got to deal with, because they've got to be able to work when they get in there, what's the rest of the stack look like? I know a little bit about SCIFs, but not a ton. I imagine that there is a visitor management component. There's an access control component. There's probably your back office administrative management, like who's actually here, where are they, who's booked what room, that kind of thing. There probably is some camera and surveillance stuff that you have to worry about. What are the different pieces, and which of those has been particularly difficult?
I'm going to talk about a kind of terrifying story real quick, John, to answer that. So there was we talked about this previously before the call started, but there was an incident maybe two and a half years ago up in Massachusetts from a National Guardsman who was a young guy, young kid, had many, many clearances that would be surprising for somebody of that age and experience. And he wanted to prove to his gaming buddies that he had access to that level of information. And in order to prove it to people he had never met, just people online, he decided that he was going to sneak material out of a SCIF and post it on Discord to prove to his gaming buddies that he had access.
I mean, there are a lot of dumb ones, but that's...
This is an espionage from a nation state sponsored, you know, background person.
Right.
Yeah. This was a kid who did it because he could, and there was nothing to stop him. To those of us in the intel and security industry, the terrifying truth is that SCIFs are training and trust enabled. It is about the savviness of that particular security staff at that particular location. Once people have clearances, there's a high degree of trust that they're going to do the right thing. That's why they have a security clearance. These sites aren't technology enabled. And, you know, there's a reticence on the part of a lot of the security apparatus to embrace a technology approach because technology is scary, right? It can be exploited in ways that, you know, the safest box is one you can never get into. So a disconnected environment has always kind of been seen as like, well, this is the safest way to do things, right? But the alternative is that there's thousands of people every day, every week, hand delivering classified information around the country because they can't email each other, right? That is not terribly secure either. That's actually a much worse situation. There's no auditability. There's no traceability. So when we took a look at that and saw that insight that, hey, these, you know, most SCIFs, you know, this is the reality, the training and trust, there's no, he was able to do it because there was nothing there to stop him other than other humans who were being exceptionally vigilant. And guess what? Humans aren't terribly vigilant. That's not our strong suit. So when we take a look at this, you know, the vision for Nooks is that we have, you know, 100 shared in SCIF infrastructure sites around the country, 50 or so mobile units that are deployable. How the hell are you going to manage that and me be able to sleep at night, right? Us to be able to feel comfortable and confident that we are the most secure we could possibly be. The only way to do that in our minds is by embracing a higher technology stack. So what are the commercially available technologies today that could be incorporated into the secure environment that enhance the security and streamline the operations in a way that no other site can really replicate? And this is where the business model, and I think where the, you know, part of the innovation comes from. Right now, nobody spends a dime more on their SCIF than they absolutely have to, right? It is a compliance thing, right? I'm doing it because I have to do it, right? Not because I don't want to do it. So you are incentivized to spend as least amount of money as possible. Well, for us, it's our primary offering. It is how business makes money. So we are incentivized to spend as much on that thing as we possibly need to in order to make a great product and allow us to sleep at night in the fact that it's secure. So we're actually on a couple of interesting government contracts that allow us to do some of that prototyping about, hey, how can we get these things incorporated into the secure environment in a really smart way? And honestly, John, our truest hope here is that we can revolutionize how secure infrastructure is run with the best of breed technologies out there incorporated into a single security platform in a way that nobody else has done before. So it's a huge challenge, especially in the regulatory environment, but we think that's what it's going to take to really do this right at scale.
Yeah, excellent. And we talked a little bit about great power competition. Yeah. We touched on it, but I'd love to hear more on your take on why is this a great power competition problem? I mean, what is, if we screw this up, and specifically this, I mean, we're talking about the ability of companies to work in secure places so that they could share information, advance government missions that they're working on. Why is messing that up a great power competition problem?
So for your listeners who are informed on the defense industrial base, the DIB, you know, defense tech, there's this concept called the DoD Valley of Death out there where, you know, the government will fund all of these you know, small companies, startups, non-traditionals to do some work, do some research and development. And what has happened regularly is that we can't get those companies across the finish line into actually deploying their solutions to the warfighter at any sort of meaningful scale. There's not one reason for it. There's multiple reasons for it. Going from R&D funding to, no kidding, program funding is exceptionally difficult and in years in the making, literally. There is no established contract vehicle for them. Connecting user buyers and sellers can be very difficult in this environment. But the other vector of that is that all of the most interesting use cases for the government are on the classified side. And it is years. So like the journey that a new entrant, you know, a new company into the defense intelligence world has is that they are probably going to spend years figuring out the whole just normal contracting stuff, right, to work with the government. Eventually, they might get sponsored for a security clearance, and that's going to be, you know, a year or so, you know, hopefully less than a year. DCSA has been doing a better job of getting it down, but let's call it a year for this purpose. To eventually be sponsored to build a SCIF, to eventually get, maybe get secure networks installed at that site. That is a 5, 6, 7, 10-year journey for companies. So when we're talking about great power competition, we're talking about the next 3 years, right? We're talking about what can be done now that affects an outcome in a competition between civilizations. That ain't you, right? If we're going to go through the normal process of doing this, that like we literally can't work with the best parts of our own economy. So, you know, the government's saying the right words these days. They're saying we must go faster. We must break down barriers. We must break down walls. We must do acquisition reform. The one thing that nobody has solved is the classified component. How do you have ready-made infrastructure and ability to get people through that process as streamlined, efficient as possible, using all the correct security apparatus and processes, but do it in a more efficient way? Until we solve that, we are going to be extremely hampered in actually instituting acquisition reform and getting those folks across the Valley of Death and getting that technology into our most sensitive programs in the hands of warfighters. So it is it's been known in the defense industry for a long time that this is a huge barrier to entry and barrier to scale, but we haven't really done anything about it, right? Like there's this sense of learned helplessness. Like it's just too hard, right? Like we can't mess with that. We're going to go for the low hanging fruit because it's easier to grab. And it is, but somebody has to solve this, right? Somebody has to solve this bridge over the valley of, you know, one of the bridges over the Valley of Death and lowering that barrier of entry and barrier to scale, or we are not going to be able to be nearly as competitive or effective as a nation. And so we have a very strong thesis, and if you can't tell, you know, pretty mission-driven in terms of outcomes. And it's one of the reasons, by the way, I think it's actually good that in our case, we don't, like the founders and a lot of our employees didn't have hardcore security background. We were fighter pilots. We were operators. We were much more focused on outcomes than necessarily what's possible or not possible or in traditional interpretation of policy. So,
yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Well, let's switch a little bit to the solution. Yeah. And I mean that in the broadest sense, you touched on some of those themes, what the DIB needs to do, what the government needs to do, what the regulatory environment needs to be. In addition to that, I would love to hear, if someone were not familiar with Nooks and they got the one sentence version, they might think, oh, these guys are just running. Talk a little bit about why you are solving a much bigger problem than that and what that solution is. What's unique about how Nooks is attacking this problem and how that fits into the broader solution to some of these problems we've just talked about.
What Nooks does is that we go into commercial real estate and we'll lease an entire floor, two floors, however many. We get the secure facility built under our government contract. Our government contract is for classified infrastructure as a service. So for the first time, the government...
They had to admit that.
We had to do a lot of work to craft the right thing in a way that everybody was comfortable with. Because again, it all comes down to contractual requirements. So it gets built and accredited under our contract. The government is not paying us to build them. The government is sponsoring the permissions. And then they pay for what they use, and industry pays for what it uses. And it's the shared infrastructure model, right? So it's our people running the security. It's our people running the IT to the max extent that we're allowed to. And then you would simply be a user in the space. You essentially sign up for a gym membership. And that gym membership gets you access to any of the sites that we operate nationally at any classification level that you are authorized to and is available at the site. And it's meant to really lean into the flexible access nature of this. And there's actually some good commercial examples. So this is kind of terrifying for most people, but it resonates with folks in the industry. Most SCIFs sit empty for most of the time, like 80 to 90% of the time, a lot of these things are just sitting empty.
And, right.
But few folks are very reluctant to share them because when you need it, you absolutely need it. They're training and trust enabled, right? And so the truth is that a lot of these things are, they're an asset at rest. They're not doing anything. So how can we take that to our advantage and say, well, you, John, don't need a access. You don't need a full-time seat. What you need is some time in the facility, right? What you need is a few hours a month or a week, whatever. So we are very much on a consumption-based model. The more you use, the more you pay, but the more you use, the less your unit cost essentially goes down. So it's the same model as cloud, right? It's the same model as any sort of fractional infrastructure play out there. And I think for us, you kind of mentioned in the beginning, like we're a weird combination of categories of company. We're not a real estate company. We don't buy buildings. We're not a defense company. We don't make weapons. We're a defense prop tech would probably be the best description of us, which just puts it in how many, guess how many of those there are out there, right? We're in a pretty unique category, but that's where, you know, those gaps and seams are where you find a lot of the really great ideas out there. It's just where, you know, what is, if you fit cleanly into one category, it's probably already been done before, right? There's lots of drone companies. There's lots of AI companies. But guess how many companies could actually even dream of solving something like this, right? The right founding, the right type of money that you've raised from, the right contracts. It's exceptionally difficult to put the whole picture together. So that's our primary offering, is this shared access, flexible access model to fixed facilities in locations. And the vision for that is you take the top 20 to 30 markets and put 3 to 4 in each one. It doesn't take a whole lot of imagination on how to get to 100 sites nationally pretty quickly. We also have these mobile units that are essentially ship containers that can go anywhere. Right now, those are relocatable, but the vision is that they're 8-hour deployable, right? We can get anywhere we don't have a fixed facility, we can bring one of these mobile units with the same IT solution that's in the fixed facilities and the pod. That kind of scale, like we've completely changed who can do this work from where and how quickly. That's how we engage the best parts of the U.S. economy. We bring infrastructure to them as opposed to expecting everybody to move to D.C. or to outside of a base. For us, the network effect is important, and we'll target a mixture of both traditional defense marketplaces. Like, it's not a surprise that shared SCIFs are needed here in D.C. Like, yeah, of course, right? There's a ton of activity here. But we combine that with non-traditional talent marketplaces, Silicon Valley, Boston, New York City, Atlanta. Where is today's technical talent want to live and work? And let's bring infrastructure closer to them. This is, by the way, one of the exciting things that I've seen even over the past 10 years. Silicon Valley was very not terribly happy about working with the military not too long ago, right? And there was very high profile examples of employees going on strike and not wanting to, you know, once they learned that their company was working with the DoD for something. But this was actually part of the kind of interesting insight of my time at Meta. This generation of talent that's coming up right now, all they really want is purpose. They want for their work to mean something. And we had a joke, not to disparage the folks that were working on this, but like we had a joke, if you want something easy, like go work on Facebook stickers, right? Like you want, you know, go do some feature that somebody likes, like cool, right? Go do that. It's low stress. But the really impactful problems draw an entirely different category of talent to it. And I actually think SpaceX is a great example of this. Elon Musk has very much sold the same story that the military sells, which is I'm going to sell you a vision. I'm going to sell you a mission. And then you'll work your ass off to do it. for, and I could probably pay you less to do it too, right? So like there's a large aspect of that's okay for people. Like it's not just about money. It's about purpose in life and accomplishing something and having an impact. And so today's technical talent, man, if you give them the easy ability to work, we make it not miserable for them to work defense projects and we make it easy. We make it like, holy crap, that was a really cool experience. It's a really cool project. They want to work these things now. We don't have to convince them to work it. They want to work it. We need to make it possible for them to do that. A large piece of how we view this is that workforce, that talent marketplace, and engaging the best parts of the U.S. economy in this work and not just expecting that they're going to conform to the traditional way that the government has expected work to get done.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that's really interesting about what you're doing that I don't think I really fully appreciated when we first met, and I suspect is also the case with some of your early investors that were, you know, when you pitch VCs, people think about co-working spaces and they tend to think, okay, SMBs who don't want to pay for their own space. Yeah. And so that's probably your market space. Two of the bigger investors in your last round that just happened here a few weeks ago were Lockheed Martin and SAIC. Correct. I'm really interested in your take on how you think this model might not just change. Yes, it's going to give access to these small tech companies that they can participate in the defense industrial base, but what's the potential for it to change how big companies think about how they allocate space and how they work with companies like yours and how they maybe have more flexibility and adaptability than they might have building their own stuff when that's really not their business they're supposed to be in?
Yeah. So this was actually a fascinating journey. The fact that we have two incredible strategics like Lockheed and SAIC in the mix is incredibly validating that we're not insane. There's a model to use here. They've been fantastic, both investors and partners. Here's where it gets pretty exciting and why the timing of this is so important and also kind of terrifying. These SCIFs that exist today were very much built for a workforce that no longer exists. They are in the wrong locations. They are in the wrong amount, in the right quantity. And actually, even more scary, they're under the wrong standard. So about 13 years ago, a new standard came out. And it's been updated since then a couple different times and still is changing. But the result is that a majority, a large majority of today's existing SCIFs are obsolete. They are about to be shot in the head by the U.S. government because they do not meet today's threat environment. And it's the same thing as cybersecurity standards, right? You can't expect a static cybersecurity defense posture to work. You have to be upgrading it over time. You have to be making it better. And the government has finally said, hey, no more. We can't accept this level of risk that we've been accepting based off of the threat posture of today's environment. This is industry, government, this is everybody. There is an absolute tidal wave of pain coming to the defense and intelligence marketplace because of this access to SCIF issue. I mean, imagine over half of the existing infrastructure, which already is insufficient for today's workforce, just going away because it doesn't meet standards. What's the answer to this? And this isn't a small upgrade. This is a knock it down and start over type upgrades. A lot of the primes are viewing this, you know, and Lockheed and SAIC being two groups that have really leaned forward into this, saying like, hey, look, no, they don't want to pay for it. The government doesn't want to pay for it. Programs don't want to pay for it. So what the hell are we going to do? It's actually a perfect time to embrace a shared infrastructure model, right? Let's use this crisis as a moment in time to reimagine how this could work, reimagine what the rules about the interpretation of the existing rules should be. If for the sites that they're going to upgrade, great. They can flex into a site nearby where their workforce can be for a year or two, however long it takes to get their sites upgraded, they can move back in. There's going to be other sites that they don't need to upgrade because there's this shared infrastructure model down the street, right? So from a financial perspective, there's a huge benefit of turning a CapEx into an OpEx for them. It makes it easier for their accounting purposes. It makes a ton of sense for their SCIF upgrades. But I think one of the things that we hear repeatedly from them as well is they want access to new talent marketplaces too, right? The traditional places where they are where the government is. And so they always don't have access to the Silicon Valleys and the Austins and Bostons and New Yorks. If they can open up their aperture for where to recruit and retain talent, it's a twofer, right? They don't have to spend this, you know, waste this money on bespoke infrastructure, and they get access to new talent pools. Because again, folks can access any of the sites in our network. it's a very powerful moment in time for them to get on board.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. And congratulations on that, by the way. It's fantastic when you get those kind of people involved. The next thing I'd love to talk about, and there are a fair number of folks who listen to this podcast who are not necessarily defense industrial based, or they, if they are, it's a secondary thing. They might be in the supply chain somewhere, but that's not their primary mission. They might not deal a lot with SCIFs, but at Sign-In Solutions, one of the things, one of our biggest customer sets were companies that cared a lot about protecting security of their facilities and their people. So they had a very high risk profile. In fact, they were often defense industrial based companies and are. And two, they also prioritized the experience of the people moving in and out of those facilities so that basically it didn't suck. It should not have to suck to meet security standards, whether those are by compliance, you know, mandated by compliance or because you have very sensitive stuff to protect. But also, you know, you need to have a pleasant experience for your employees. It needs to be easy. You got to reduce the friction, which you mentioned earlier. So I think there's a lot to learn from companies like ours at Sign-In and our customers who are in that profile from companies like yours who are trying to solve those two problems at the same time. So I'm just curious what your take is. I mean, if you think about visitor management, advanced access control, biometrics, identity verification, facility monitoring. I mean, all these ingredients that I know you guys have got to solve in order to deliver that in this very, very high risk, high security environment. What do you think lower security organizations can learn from your experience that they could apply?
Yeah. So I think the question that we should be asking is, you know, why does the government use SCIFs at all, right? Like, why does anybody, why is this regulation even exist? And fundamentally, all a SCIF really is the protection of information. What are the physical and process characteristics of a site that it is exceptionally difficult to extract information from that you're not supposed to have? Well, that's not a government-only problem, right? Industry faces this problem all the time. And, you know, one of the things that we see as a potential expansion space for Nooks in the future, it's not our focus right now, but I think it's something that we all need to be thinking about, is there's just an information protection aspect of this in general. That's not DOD, IC, or government specific at all. It is just, how do companies protect their IP in a really smart way going forward? Because corporate espionage is also true, including from places like China. They're stealing plenty of just commercial tech that's available. So we see this as, hey, what are some of these companies that are not in government work actually are advantaged. They can use commercially available technologies a lot, sometimes much easier than folks in the defense industrial base can in certain circumstances. But we do see a world in which, hey, you can't afford that very secure office space yourself, that your very secure facility. The larger tech companies can, the Facebooks, the Apples, they certainly can do that, but your smaller companies and you really can't. Is there a need and an opportunity for IP protection that is similar? Quite possibly, right? And I can imagine the tagline, like, it's good enough for the CIA, it's good enough for you, right? So there's got to be something there.
Great tagline.
Yeah. So we anticipate a large IP marketplace here too. It's not something we're focused on right now, but absolutely for your users out there, I'm sure there's use cases out there that exist that this would be useful.
Yeah, that makes sense. I learned a ton about leadership of teams when I was in. I'm sure you did too. What are the big things at Nooks that you prioritize? Look, it is not easy to build a company from scratch in an environment that nobody's done it before, and then go raise around to solve a very capital intensive problem from very big companies. I mean, what you've done is pretty remarkable, requires leadership. What are the big lessons that we should take away from your experience?
Well, first off, my job this whole journey is to suck a little bit of less every single day, right? Just trying to learn something, trying to get better. From the team's perspective, I think we have a pretty unique culture here at Nooks because it's the clash of a couple different types of people. We have this very strong DOD background presence for folks that have spent their whole careers in military and government. It's absolutely required to get something like this done. And the government knows that they can trust because we have that national security first mindset. So that's an absolute must within our organization. There's also this element of startup of, hey, I'm going to go, you know, break some glass. I'm going to go make some stuff happen. And whatever that takes, we're going to go do, right? Those two cultures are actually like very, they're not in conflict, but like it creates a healthy friction inside of us where it's like, okay, got it. The government says X, they don't think they get there. How can we help? How can we help them get there in a really smart way? Let's go, go, go. And that friction has actually been pretty cool to watch develop. And I think it's kind of baked into, you know, our DNA in a lot of ways. And even just the folks that join those who are willing to join a startup. And a lot of our folks are coming from, you know, from very large, you know, defense primes or the government itself. I kind of joke that, like, you kind of have to be a little bit pissed off to work at Nooks. And it's true. Like, you really kind of have to be like, have a certain level of dissatisfaction with the way the world works to want to have the motivation to change something like this. The company itself, like, we were born out of rage more than anything else, right? Like, this is a dumb freaking problem. How do we go solve it?
I get it.
Yeah.
I totally know what you mean.
Right, so how do you bottle that, right? How do you capture that in your interview process and people that you bring in? What it generally means is a high degree of passion, a high degree of grit, of folks that are just going to do anything they possibly can to get the job done. And also, never compromise trust, never compromise integrity when it comes to the protection of information. It's a unique category of people that join Nooks. There's another interesting clash within our, I think, healthy friction place inside of Nooks, which is security versus hospitality. We actually just sent out a book to all of our employees called Unreasonable Hospitality. And actually, if you've ever seen the show The Bear on TV?
I have. It's good stuff.
Good stuff, right? Actually, they mentioned this book and that a lot of the stories from that show come from the book. But it's actually a really healthy tension inside of us. Like, we both have to do hardcore security, right? That has to be in our DNA. But we also have to be hardcore hospitality on how do we help folks solve the security-related problems and get them through and get them in, you know, so long as they are cleared and authorized, how do we figure this out within existing law and policy? That tension and that friction is another place inside of Nooks that is always going to be there. And I've been really proud of our existing employees on how they've struggled those concepts and figure out how to adopt them. The future of Nooks is going to be all of those things, DoD, startup, security, hospitality. You smash all these things together and you wind up with a pretty cool place to work.
That is pretty neat. And I love the security and hospitality dichotomy. I mean, we had the exact same kind of tension at Sign-In, but it was focused on security. We called it a security and experience.
I love that.
But it is that, I mean, I think most companies who are in these spaces tend to lean into one or the other. So either you're out there trying to, you know, in our case, it was, you know, visitor management compliance. Either you're trying to just make everything easy and delightful, or you're trying to dial in, you know, rigorous security and protect everything until the box can't be opened, right? You can't do one or the other. You have to do both. You have to.
Here's your skip. And here's your
love that you guys get that. That's just fantastic. Really neat stuff. A few rapid fire questions to wrap up here. I'll have it to tell everybody we have not run these by you in advance. So these should all be a surprise. The first one, I'm sure you've been asked this before, but I have to ask it. What are some things that you still take from being a fighter pilot into your daily job at Nooks?
Yeah. Brief, fly, debrief. And there's no rank in the cockpit. So just to audible this, you know, one of the things that the fighter pilot community does very well, and people assume, you know, the stereotype of like, you know, arrogant fighter pilot. Yeah, sure, it exists. You have to be cocky to do something like that to a certain extent. But what they don't talk about is you get beat up all the time. You are told how you suck regularly. Nobody is perfect. Everybody is learning how to execute the mission well when it comes to flying. And so one of the things that the culture of the community has done very, very well is like, okay, we're going to plan for what we're going to do. We're going to go do it. And we're going to talk about it. We're going to extract every single lesson learned that we can so we can get better and we learn better. We encourage each other. It doesn't matter if you're the skipper, right? It doesn't matter if you're the most senior person there. If me as the most junior pilot there can't tell you, hey, skipper, you just screwed that up, then that's a problem, right? You need to be able to challenge authority in a respectful but smart way, right? Actually, that helps people improve. So that absolutely is brought into Nooks. The other thing is there's no rank in the cockpit. It's kind of a similar concept of like, look, if you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong. There cannot be ego around some of these things. And if I'm screwed up, I must have my team feel confident that they can tell me, hey, jacked up on this. So that's unfortunate in the fact that we have a lot of aviators in the company and that culture has spread. But those are the two things that come to mind first.
Awesome. Next question is easier. It is a Navy question, although most people won't see it as that. How many cups of coffee today?
Oh, God.
And you take it.
Oh, okay. So this is the sad thing. I don't know how many cups of coffee because I just stopped counting. I drank so many very crappy cups of coffee in the Navy, usually black and cold, maybe with some powdered creamer if it was hot. These days, French vanilla creamer. every time. Love it. I'm addicted to it.
You get negative for lost time.
I make negative for lost time. So I love Fufu coffee. I won't get the Fufu drinks at Starbucks or whatever, but just give me some French vanilla cream and I'm probably happy.
All right, next one. If you were not building Nooks, what would you be doing?
Man, that's a great question. So one of the things that's always, it would probably still be in the, you know, it'd be in the technology space, almost certainly. What kind of technology? I don't know, to be honest. I know that I have a great deal of passion for how are we as a society going to be using technology in the next 100 years? And what does it actually mean for us? My time at Facebook with anti-misinformation operations, you know, this is about enabling technologists to be able to move fast into really important aspects. Honestly, either DevTech or CivTech is a space that I would probably be looking into. I think I'm incredibly fortunate to be beginning to build a company in the kind of the post GPT age, right, where you can incorporate all these things from the start. But some of the technologies out there right now are game changing, are going to completely change the scope of what we're doing. I will say this just as a general point, I think I'd be working on something that is at the intersection of society and technology, because we don't have the balance right yet, right? We're launching these technologies, things are happening faster and faster. And I think a lot of the social struggles that we have today as a society are just the world changing so fast and none of us being able to catch up. So we're getting this whiplash between sides because the human brain just wasn't meant to do this so fast. So being at the intersection of those things, I've always found fascinating. And you know, if it wasn't Nooks, I would hope it would be something like that.
Awesome. All right. Well, I'll give you the final word of the podcast today, and really just would love for you to tell the listeners one thing, if they remember nothing else from our conversation today, that you think that they need to know. What is that? What do they need to remember?
Find hard problems and solve them. It is, I think, for all of us, we are living in this incredible age where we've never had more access to tools and technology and access than any before. I'd encourage all the listeners just not to get discouraged by life and stuff and society and just keep on trying to find things that are hard. You'll find the passion in what you do when it's challenging and hard. Every single day, I know I wake up and my team makes me better, but it's an incredible honor to be able to be executing on something like this. But it means that you feel like you suck, right? They feel like that you're outside of your comfort zone, but that's really where the goodness is. So last word is, you know, Nooks, we are dedicated to solving this problem. It is solvable. It is not intractable. It is caused by humans and can be solved by humans. But I encourage everybody to find those things in your own sphere and help push our society better together. We are better together than we are separated. And to find those things that bind us together is really important right now.
Awesome. Thank you, Sean. This has been an absolute delight. Loved our conversation. Hope to do another one sometime in the future, because I think we probably could have talked about 25 other things that would have been just as interesting. So thank you for your time. Super excited to share this with our audience, and hope that you are successful post round and just take off, because you guys are doing fantastic work on a very important problem. Great stuff.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us on Secure Access, brought to you by Sign In Solutions. If you found today's conversation insightful, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. For more on transforming compliance, security, and workplace experiences, visit signinsolutions.com. Until next time, stay secure, stay informed.